Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everyone. This is the aforementioned Sal with a special edition of Midrats today. Unfortunately, my co-host, the illustrious Eagle One, he is in travel at the moment, won't be able to join us, but we've got a great hour today. Originally, we weren't scheduled to have a show, and of course, that's when the world decides to get a lot interesting on both the land and the maritime side of the house. And lo and behold, we got a show for you that, especially for those that are focused on the maritime issues, as most of our listeners are, I think you're really going to enjoy the guest we have today, as we're going to look at the maritime side of the equation from the conflict that's going on with the Russian invasion from Ukraine. Is rightfully most people are focused ashore where the major effort is taking place, but there are significant developments not just for Ukraine, but for the entire periphery of the nations of Black Sea, NATO, and the global trade environment from the Sea of Azov in the east all the way to the Danube Delta in the west. There's a lot going on, whether it involves longstanding treaties, neutral shipping, possible amphibious landings, sea lines of communication security. And we're going to touch on that and probably more today as we go forward with two guests returning to Midrats. First of all, we're going to have journalist Chris Cavas, who also hosts his own podcast, Cavas Ships, and also returning guest and host of his podcast as well, What's Going On with Shipping, Dr. Sal Marcogliano. Chris and Sal, welcome back to Midrats.
Great to be here, Sal. Thanks.
Sal, thanks for the invite. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. And I figured to kick things off, let me go ahead and roll the first question over to Sal, and then Chris weigh in as well, because for those that like to study their history or really bad Brad Pitt movies, there's all the way back to archaic Greece and the Battle of Troy. The trade coming out of the Black Sea to the rest of the world has been critical, not only to keep people fed, but to keep people at work and having the raw materials from that very rich part of the world going to where the markets are. And, you know, let's kick off there, because whether you're even, you know, sitting here in North America or in Asia, this conflict is going to attack us, attack you and your standard of living. So let's go ahead and talk about the impact on global trade from your perspective, Sal.
Yeah, I think it's one of the big stories probably under the surface that quite hasn't resonated yet, but we're definitely going to see it become a larger and larger issue. Ukraine exports about 10% of the world's grain. And so therefore, it is the breadbasket for a lot of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. And this disruption, and when we talk about it, when we look at the naval aspects, is really geared to cutting Ukraine off from that transportation. It really can't haul it overseas because it can't switch over to the different rail gauges in Europe. It's still on the old Soviet rail gauge. So the ports, initially Sevastopol, but then lost in Crimea in 2014, and now Odessa. And, you know, this goes back throughout history. You were mentioning the Greeks, obviously, the very famous story of the ancient Greeks, the Mycenaeans, piling up and supposedly going to go, the fleet that Helen launched, 1,000 ships. But in truth, it was economics. The Greeks saw an opportunity to bust up the control, the monopoly that Troy held over that grain coming out of the Black Sea. And if you fast forward even just a century ago, Nick Lambert's most recent book, The Warlords and the Gallipoli Disaster, the subtitle of that book is How Globalized Trade Led to Britain to the Worst Defeat of the First World War the British storming ashore along with the Australians and New Zealanders and the French in Gallipoli to get into the Black Sea to get at that Ukrainian wheat. So this has been an issue for a long time. So I think the economic implications we're going to see here is going to be significant if that Ukrainian wheat is cut off.
Of course, you're not even talking about all the sanctions and what all those results remain to be seen. There are going to be ripple effects all over, but exactly how we still haven't. It has yet to be played out.
Yeah, well, and Chris, I think that
sanctions are going to be huge.
Yeah, and Chris, that brings in one thing that I've been looking for. I mean, you have a tremendous background in media from a variety of ways, and you've got a real keen eye to how journalism and media works on reporting issues, especially things that develop on a regular basis. And that economic tie-in, the only thing that's been more difficult to find some really good reporting on, probably because people are still trying to figure out, is that economic tie-in. But also some of the maritime considerations that we are talking about for the next hour. What do you see so far from the reporting that obviously it's very land-centric? And where are the places that you are finding has some really good reporting that people should be looking at, especially if they're focused on some of the maritime and economic impacts?
Boy, there's just so much stuff. Sal, I can't even point to any one thing. I mean, that's part of the aspect of what's going on is everything is so diffuse now. I mean, example of what you're doing right here. You know, you're a guy with a podcast. There's a lot of people with a podcast. There's a lot of people with, I don't know, a phone. And each one of those phones can go live to the world. So, you know, who's really good right now? I mean, there's so many things. I have enjoyed some of the think tanks who've had pretty good informative talks about this. Atlantic Council is a really good one. Pay attention to those. But, you know, there are the official accounts that you pay attention to. I mean, you really should be looking at the NATO account. You need to be looking at the European community. You need to look at all these official things. You need to see what the Pentagon's actually putting out. Pentagon is actually doing a pretty good effort, have all along, and they've ramped it up at briefing the media, keeping the media informed about a lot of things, far more than what they usually do. And they of course, it's always up to a certain point. Information is you always have to be careful about revealing your sources, but they've been telegraphing this all along, and they keep briefing the media all through this weekend. They're still doing it, not always on camera, sometimes background briefings, but fairly detailed. They're not going into order of battle stuff like that. They don't want to talk about specific. The results of specific attacks, they're not going to go to that level with the media, but they will talk in general about a lot of things that they're fairly good. I mean, but this is the world we live in now. There is no single source. There's not even half a dozen sources. There's all kinds of things. And I watch BBC fairly often. That's my go-to for actual news. The American networks tend to be on top of issues more than stories. The BBC is pretty good, but sometimes the U.S. Networks can have fantastic stuff. Really, they're on the ground. The problem with looking at all this stuff on the internet is checking the validity, and this is a whole other area where all the major media outlets now have people working full time and full time 24 hours, trying to verify media as much as they can. Geolocation has become a big thing. Can we figure out exactly where this is? Does this say something? And sometimes people have zeroed right in about this is an event that happened on this tarmac, on this road, in front of this building. And then other things have been shown to be totally false. Something that was, that's true, but that was in 2014. That was Donbass thing in 7 years ago. This sort of thing. Some of the efforts at disinformation are pretty ham-handed. Some of them are pretty sophisticated. It can be a real challenge sifting through things. For example, right now, the talk about the head of the Russian military resigning because he didn't look terribly happy at sitting near Putin. Nobody's sitting next to Putin right now. That's a rumor going around, but it's pretty hard to verify. And we'll talk about the Montreux Convention and whether Turkey's going to close the Turkish Straits or not. There's a lot of different stories out there about it. They have not decided to do that, but there's been social media reports that it has, that they have done it. You got to be careful.
Sal?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yep, go ahead, Sal.
No, I thought, sorry, it's going to be confusing with the two Sals talking with the third person today. No, I agree with Chris. I think there's a lot of sources. There's a lot of sources out there to be looking at. You know, my perspective tends to be looking at what's going on the commercial, on the international shipping side. So, you know, I've been following the Institute for the Study of War. They've been doing a great update on the campaign, on the military side of it. Groups like Lloyd's List and GCAPN have been really following the maritime side. Dryad Global has been doing really good on getting assessments of vessels being hit, and also the issue with the Turkish Straits right now that Chris alluded to, which I think is a big issue. You know, obviously this conflict has expanded and gotten a lot bigger than everybody envisioned it would. You know, we've already seen three commercial vessels hit out in the Black Sea, and we've seen naval operations off the coast of Ukraine on a scope and a scale I don't think very much of us thought we would expect to see in a Russian incursion into Ukraine. So, you know, I've just been trying to soak it in. I agree with Chris. One of the problems here is not lack of information, it's too much information, and where are the good sources and validating? There's a lot of information flying out there right now.
Well, you know, Sal, one thing to think about is it's hard to get information, but you can kind of look at least from what you've been able to peel off so far, is what is the strategy of the two combatants? Now, in 2014, with the loss of Crimea, the Ukrainians lost a lot of their naval power, and they've been limited on what they've been able to build up. Again, you know, I haven't seen it validated, but there's a report that their one remaining Krivak they've scuttled. I don't know. But considering the monsters the Russians have going up and down the coast, if I was a skipper of a Krivak, I wouldn't want to leave port either. But talk for a bit about what you're seeing so far on the maritime strategy that the Russians are using in the Black Sea. And on the other flip of the coin, what do you think some of the things the Ukrainians can do, given the scale of what we've seen the Russians do so far from the sea?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to watch them play out exactly what we would talk about should be like strategies for the U.S. Navy. And I'd argue that they're doing everything that we would talk about the U.S. Navy has put down, for example, in missions for I don't know how long now we've been talking about this, but you see them kind of go right down the list, and they are doing everything, you know, by the book. And so, you know, when you talk about missions, you know, strategic deterrence, you know, we see that. We see them doing kind of the strategic deterrence mission. They're out there in force, overwhelming force against the Ukrainians, really deterring anybody from coming in and interfering. They've exercised sea control. I mean, they've been able to get their forces. And, you know, we can make the argument, well, these are Russian naval forces. They haven't built a substantial heavy vessel since the end of the Cold War. But in this type of operation, it's proving that they have the capabilities. You know, they're running around with 1970s, you know, Rapucha LSTs, but that's what they need for this mission, and they're being successful in executing their mission. They're projecting power ashore. You know, one of the big things, I think, if you look at what the Russians seem to be doing, is drive on two axes. The first axis is toward the capital of Kiev, and so they're heading toward Kiev. They're coming out of Belarus and northern Russia, driving on the Capitol. It's pretty clear they're interested in regime change in Ukraine. But then the other mission that they're doing that it's not getting a lot of press, but I think it's an important one, is they're driving out of Crimea and out of Donbass to link those two regions overland to get a land route to Sevastopol, which has been an issue that they've been wanting to do the entire time. And, you know, the last mission they're doing is naval presence. They've got that huge fleet sitting there at Taurus in Syria, tying up, you know, the U.S. and the NATO navies to keep an eye on them. So, I mean, it appears, you know, even though they've got limited resources and, you know, there's a lot of questionality, I would argue, about the Russian Navy and their capabilities, they seem to be executing a pretty good strategy and, you know, following the missions that a Navy should do. I saw an amazing satellite picture not too long ago of them reloading some of their naval vessels kind of pier side using a crane, you know, because they're shooting off ballistic missiles and shore bombardment missiles from their vessels. So they seem to be doing replenishment right at the docks there in Ukraine so that they can get their vessels reloaded and back out on station. I think it's going to be an interesting operation to peel back and look at in the future. I know we're talking about in presence and people are dying right now, so I completely have sympathy for this. But, you know, in terms of executing a naval mission, they seem to be doing a good job of it.
So there are several aspects to that, if I could weigh in on that. They've got these two amphibious groups together carrying naval infantry. And, of course, the geography says that you have to have two if you're doing what they are doing. So you have one group that's in the Sea of Azov. This is sort of this inland area behind north of the Crimean Peninsula. And they have reportedly already landed about 30 kilometers west of Mariupol, which is the major port, major Ukrainian port on the Sea of Azov. That's okay. There's another group that is off Odessa at the other end out of the Black Sea. I have not seen any credible reports that they have been put ashore yet. One thing that the Russians do not practice is opposed amphibious assault landings. So they don't do D-Day, if you will. They are going in a relatively benign, secure environment. So they need a welcoming committee. They need somebody to secure the area ahead of them before they put their troops ashore. There's no indication that they're even close to that around Odessa. Although, you know, who knows? For all I know, it's going on tonight. But that hasn't happened yet. The in the Black Sea, they have their navy consists these days mostly of rather effective small combatants, and this is a class of ship that the United States Navy has zero interest in. They're coastal. They're certainly not blue water ships that can cross oceans. But they're 600 tons, or a 900-ton one is a fairly large one. But a lot of these very small vessels can carry caliber NK cruise missiles, which, you know, Tomahawk-ski, a basic missile that has been around for some decades, but like a lot of these missiles has been upgraded over the years to become a far more effective missile and take direction from offboard sources. So they're essentially missile carriers. They're not doing the targeting. They're not doing targeting direction, but they are launchers. And this is right down a road in a concept called distributed lethality. And the Russians do this like nobody's business. So that even there's even the Caspian Sea flotilla, which is to the east of the Black Sea, an inland sea all the way. Although there are river and canal connections out of that. These small craft in the Caspian Sea have to be taken into account. Their missiles can reach out several hundred, 800 miles or so, and you really have to take those into consideration. They've used those relatively effectively in Syria. There are a number of those. They also have 7 kilo class upgraded, more modern models of the vaunted Kilo class diesel electric submarine. Still very effective boats. And they are armed also as well with caliber NK missiles. and they've probably, I'm not sure of all the platforms being used to launch them. There's been video of clearly caliber missiles being used here. So they're using those for shore bombardment of some type. And then there's a whole other element with the Project 1164 Slava-class missile cruisers. This is a 1970, late 70s, early 80s design. There were going to be more. They completed only three of them. I've actually been on board one. I was on board one, the Marshal Ustinov, in Norfolk Naval Base in July 1989. It was a period of, if everybody remembers, Glasnost, and the opening between George Herbert Walker Bush and Gorbachev, Glasnost meaning openness. And here was this missile cruiser that was designed to do absolutely nothing except attack and destroy American aircraft carriers sitting in the heart of our largest naval base, flying the flag of the Soviet Union and all these Soviet sailors. And it was one of the more surreal events I've ever been to. Can't believe this is happening. Can't believe I'm looking at that ship. Can't believe it's here. Can't believe they're letting me on board. And I think it was just as surreal for the Soviets as it was for us. It is interesting to note that on that day in July 1989, when I was on board that ship, with the exception of a couple of aircraft carriers, virtually every American ship in that very large base, our largest base, is gone. All the destroyers, all the cruisers, all the frigates, all the submarines, they've all been decommissioned, scrapped, sunk as targets. They're gone. Marshal Ustinov is still one of the major fleet units of the Russian Navy. And they have three of these in service. They distributed them, one in the Marshal Ustinov is part of the Northern Fleet, up in the Severomorsk, Murmansk area. There's another one, the Varyag, which is based in Vladivostok in the Pacific Fleet. And the last one, the Moskva, formerly the Slava, is the Black Sea Fleet ship. That ship, and they were actually out of service for quite some years. They spent some years putting it back together. They're in full service now, apparently. And all three have been brought to bear here in a very slow moving choreography. The Marshal Ustinov came out from Murmansk for exercises in the North Atlantic. Was part of these things off the southwest coast of Ireland, and then kept on coming through the Mediterranean. The Varyag deployed on 29 December from Vladivostok on a public relations tour of several ports. There's a destroyer and a tanker with her, and they came out, visited India, visited Iran, did a nice series of exercises in Iran, off Iran, the Gulf of Oman with Iranians and the Chinese squadron that's out there, the anti-piracy squadron, and then came through Suez. And it wasn't clear what was going on here until they all kind of stopped and held station for a while. So Moskva was underway in the Black Sea, and you were sort of expecting it to come out of the Black Sea. And it didn't. It stayed in the Black Sea, very much underway. It may have been the primary ship, I'm not sure, that was involved in the now infamous Snake Island incident of a day or two ago. The Varyag has hung off the Syrian coast in the eastern Mediterranean. And the Marshal Ustinov sat out in the central Mediterranean, Ionian Sea area, sort of west of Crete. Well, what that was a triangular disposition. Each of these ships carries 16 of these very large SSN-12 sandbox missiles, again, designed to do nothing except blow up an American aircraft carrier. And they sat there as the U.S. was making a demonstration, U.S. and NATO, of an operation called Neptune Strike, getting the Harry S. Truman strike group together, with the French Charles de Gaulle, with the Italian Cavour, and doing photo ops to show resolve in the Adriatic Sea off between Italy and Croatia. But those ships, if that NATO force, if those aircraft carriers were getting within strike fighter range of, let's say, Odessa, they would also be within sandbox range. So this is not something everybody was certainly aware of this. It's no big secret. Anybody paying attention has been able to figure this out. Absolutely, the U.S. Navy figured this out. Absolutely, people are ready for this, and absolutely they're looking to A, you know, counter a missile, any missile attack, and B, counter their ships. But that was a pretty effective disposition. Classic, totally classic, right out of, you know, Tom Clancy books. This is what they were built to do, and they've sat around for all these years and never had to put this into form, and now they actually did it. So
it's interesting watching it. I did a little post last week, the last cruise of the Giants, that all the sailors right now at sea, if they're around them, remember it, because these ships are at the end of their life plus, and the Russians aren't building anything like them again. They have a nice model of a cruiser, but that's about it. This is really a snapshot in time. And you painted a really good picture of what the Russians have done, Chris, to place their ships. And as I always do, I like to encourage people, go to the map, look at the Black Sea. And if you look at the Black Sea, if you go from the 4 o'clock position clockwise around to the 10 o'clock position, you've got NATO nations, Turkey, Bulgaria, and Romania. And there's just neither one of those navies really have a great naval presence in the Black Sea, but NATO's just really kind of backed into the background while all this is going on. You know, why do you think NATO, and perhaps it was a prudent step, has decided to just back up from, you know, almost the entire Black Sea, turn it effectively into a Russian lake?
Well, remember, Turkey's there. Turkey has a substantial naval presence. They control the entrance and the exit to the Black Sea. Their ships move back and forth at will. They have a very effective submarine fleet. It's not out of the realm of possibility that the Turks had a submarine or two watching the Moskva in the Black Sea. Should they start to target non-Ukrainian targets. That's a real thing. And the other part is that, again, Turkey controls those Turkish straits. The rules of that are governed by the Montreux Convention of 1936. Non-resident navies, non-resident countries, in other words, countries who don't live along the Black Sea, like the United States, you can't send a ship in there and stay there, a military ship. You've got to come out after about 2 weeks. And you have to stay out for a period of time. You can leapfrog them, but you don't want to be caught in there. And the Turks could close those straits. And they're very narrow straits. This is not the Bosphorus at Istanbul, and the Dardanelles at the Mediterranean side are quite narrow and easily controlled. And as you alluded to in your intro, the scene of great conflict in previous years and previous centuries. The Dardanelles are littered today, even today, with the wrecks of the assaults of 1915, where a number of French and British battleships were sunk. They're still out there.
I had a great seaside dinner there late 1990s, and it is a shockingly narrow choke point.
Mm-hmm. Which part? Where? In the Bosphorus or in the Dardanelles?
Over in Istanbul proper, right?
The Bosphorus.
Right. Sofia.
Yeah. So the Golden Horn is in there, and these are ancient waterways, strewn with the wrecks that are out there are classic stuff that go back to antiquity. But and the conflict between Turkey in all its forms, and Russia in all its forms, over control of the Black Sea and Crimea and the Bosphorus, is an ancient struggle. Obviously, the Crimean War of 1854, the World War I, and this is a ancient area of conflict. They know their history far more than Americans know it.
I would just add one thing to what Chris said, because I do agree. You know, Turkey has a huge naval presence there. I mean, substantial. Romania, Bulgaria, not as much. I mean, the Bulgarians are running former Belgian frigates that have been refitted with, you know, more modern sensors and weapons. And then the Romanians have a pair of British Type 22s that they're running. But I do think it's important that NATO, the last NATO vessel, you know, non of those three navies, had pulled out back in January. I think it was a French vessel was the last one that was up there. The Arleigh Burke pulled out in December, and then a French vessel pulled out in January. And I think not having a vessel up on the Black Sea from one of the other, you know, non-Black Sea nations, you know, I don't know what kind of indication that gave to Putin in many ways. I think it would have been interesting to see if there was another vessel up there, if Putin was willing to go, whether or not they were there. You can make the argument he was going to go no matter what, and that's probably true. But I do think it raises that question about the location of the NATO naval forces, particularly after three vessels were struck, one of them a Turkish vessel, one a Moldavian vessel, and one was under a Marshall Islands flag. It was owned by
commercial ships.
Right, commercial ships. Right. Commercial ships. And so, you know, I just raised that question about it because I do think it's an interesting one to discuss.
Oh, I think there's no way I'd have put anybody up there. I might have made a foray in January when nothing was going to happen. I might have sent a Burke up in there just to say nah, 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 which is really the mission anyway, and then pulled him out. You don't want to be up there when combat starts. It's an inland sea. You're trapped. There's no way out, like we said. And the Montreux Convention closes. Turkey can close the straits to combatants in a time of war. And without being able to define what that is on the NATO side, you could easily have gotten somebody trapped up there and you would have lost it. And then everybody would say, well, that wasn't too bright. I'd have felt good about doing it in January, after the first week of the Olympics. I would never have done it. And the French actually were going to do another one, and they canceled it. Frigate Alsace was supposed to go in there.
Yeah,
but they canceled.
I think that was probably the prudent thing to do. You know, Sal, when I was looking at the attacks on commercial fish. Shipping and the fact that the NATO navies that we did have were staying close to home. And I was thinking back, you know, wearing both a U.S. Navy hat during one specific Comp 2X and JTFX had a big battle problem, had to do with identification of white shipping. And we did an exercise back when I was a NATO staff weenie, and that was a big part of it as well. These things happen in conflicts and stuff, but it really spoke to me that the Russian Navy hasn't practiced much in deconflicting of white shipping in a tactical environment. And those attacks weren't trying to send a message to anybody. They were just the Russian Navy just untrained for this type of environment. Perhaps that's being a little bit kind to the Russian Navy, but considering how some of their land forces have missed a couple of block checks on some basics, are you thinking that's probably what we've seen in the Black Sea is just sailors that haven't really trained for white shipping deconfliction?
Oh, I don't think they intentionally hit the three vessels that are there right now. I think that was definitely accidental. I don't think they're ready to do that type of fighting to kind of cut through the chaff and figure out what were Ukrainian vessels, were not Ukrainian vessels. We know, for example, just today, two Ukrainian bulkers were stopped by Russian vessels, and they're being brought into port now. Ukraine doesn't have a substantial commercial fleet at all, so they were probably just rounding up what was Ukrainian flag out there. And pretty much everything else has kind of gotten out of the area. I will note there's one vessel, the largest container ship on the Black Sea, sitting in Odessa right now. And it's one of the Chinese overseas shipping company vessels. She's sitting in Odessa, about a 9,500 box vessel. She hasn't left yet. And I'm not sure if she hasn't left yet because the port of Odessa's closed and the authorities won't let her go, or if the Chinese are worried that she may get hit if she comes out accidentally. So I think definitely the Russians are basically shooting at whatever target presents themselves. And in this case, several commercial vessels found themselves on the receiving end of hits.
Right.
I mean, Chris, I would assume at this stage of the game, everybody's gotten a call from their insurance providers and have told them, you know, clear out, get into port, and don't go everywhere. Because the Russians really, they haven't shown the ability to do that. And to be fair, that's not an easy thing to do, especially if you have limited air coverage to go out there and check out every little contact.
Well, Salmer Cagliano, didn't the Russians issue notices to mariners a couple of days ago saying leave the area around Ukraine, head towards the Bosphorus?
They did, and matter of fact, we saw that reflected in war risk insurance rates going up from 0.025% on the value of a vessel up to about 5%. I mean, so that was a, you know, huge increase right there in the insurance for the vessels. But they did issue a notice to mariners about clearing out the area. Now, they waited until, I think, the shooting started, too, before issuing that. I don't think it was preempted
right.
by any means.
Right. And they've got they have these two ships now. Go ahead.
No, and I don't know if either one of y'all might have seen this, but I think, you know, regardless of what happens with people's ability to access the Black Sea, with Ukraine being a top five producer of wheat, corn, and sunflowers especially, and I don't know when they usually ship most of that product, but is that what we are mostly talking about with world trade, is a possible impact on grain access and supplies? Because even if we have a ceasefire today, I would think the communications from farm to port inside Ukraine are going to take a while to repair as well. So I think there's some smart economists right now that have got to be working this impact, because it can't be small.
No, I don't think it's small at all. And you know, you see spikes in the shipment of grains. Obviously, you know, December is a big month for the winter wheat coming out. And then obviously later on in late summer, early fall, you see it too. But obviously this disruption, and you have to put it into the context too of what's going on in the global supply chain. At the same time that you're going to see a disruption of grain coming out of Ukraine, down in South America, for example, you've got a drought going on that's really cutting back on the shipment of grains coming out of South America right now, both impacting farm yields, but the ability to barge wheat and grains down key rivers in South America. On the west coast of the United States, you have issues with farmers being able to get their ag exports out due to the backlogs in the U.S. ports. And, you know, this is going to have a huge impact on inflation, food prices around the world. And as Chris alluded to, which is the other variable out there that we just don't know the impact it's going to have, is the level of sanctions that are going to be placed against the Russians. You know, are there going to be sanctions against, you know, LNG and oil imports, for example? Because that's the other great variable out there. You know, all of a sudden now, if you start losing Russian oil and Russian LNG coming in, that's going to cause massive spikes. You already see the market reacting to this right now. And one of the things I think is really interesting to note is just prior to this event, there was a series of agreements that came out between the Russians and the Chinese. Everything from the Chinese lifting restrictions on Russian wheat imports. They initially had restricted wheat imports from Russia from certain areas. There was a big deal that was hashed between Putin and Chairman Xi coming out of the Beijing Olympics about a 30-year gas deal, the construction of a pipeline over into that region. I think one of the other big ones has been this development of the Eurasia rail system, part of the Belt and Road system. China's been vastly investing in this railway system. You know, if you look at, you know, the amount of trains that have gone from Asia over into Europe, you know, in 2011, there were 17 trains that made that route each year, you know, during the course of the year. Last year, 2021, 7,323 trains. So, I mean, there's been a massive investment here by China into their infrastructure, and I think this is part of that agreement that's kind of behind the surface right here. Now, will Russia meet all its requirements by exporting to China? I don't think so, and that's going to have economic impacts, obviously.
Sal, I'm interested in your thoughts on the North. Wait, hold on. I'm sorry, Sal. Yeah. I was going to say, Mercogliano, I'm interested in your thoughts about the Arctic coast. So a lot of attention people are paying to all this development up on the Arctic coast, global warming, more accessibility. They've built a huge port up there. A lot of facilities, a lot of ships are being built to, you know, with ice-strengthened ships to take advantage of that route. But a lot of that financing is not Russian. It's coming from France. It's coming from the Netherlands. It's coming from international banks. Some of it is coming from China. But there could be a whole secondary or tertiary or whatever effect on the development of that won't manifest itself for quite some time, but it is going to slow them, I would think. What do you think?
No, I agree entirely, Chris. I think the other element in there is, you know, they've been developing the Yamal fields and that ice strengthened route, you know, what's called the Northeast Passage there, to be able to move. They jumped on this after the Ever Given incident back in March of last year when they were advertising they could move ships through that route. The other element that's not a lot of people talking about right now is South Korea has come out very strong in support of Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. South Korea is building those vessels for the Russian, for Sovcom flot, the Russian tanker fleet. You know, what happens if Korea decides to impose sanctions and not build those ships and instead sell them to the Qataris, to Americans, to whatever investors want them, and sells them out from underneath the Russians? There's a lot of economic impacts here that, and a lot of issues that are at play here. Again, you know, we have to remember, the United States imports Russian oil. We do it all the time for our refineries because we haven't built a new refinery since 1977. And so we can't process a lot of that light crude that comes out of fracking. So, you know, you see Russian oil coming into U.S. ports a lot. And, of course, you know, the last Department of Energy report for February showed that 20% of the LNG going into Europe is coming out of Europe. I mean, coming out of Russia. And the question is, can that 20% be substituted by LNG coming out of the United States, from Qatar, from Australia? Are there enough tankers? If there's enough storage capacity? You just had the German prime minister, or chancellor, excuse me, talk about the fact that they're going to build two LNG terminals, which is great, but that's going to take time. You know, we've been talking about the issue about German and European dependence on Russian energy. But now they seem to be shifting around, but they may be too deep to detach themselves from that Russian energy right now.
That was the real interesting development that I saw that in the last 24 hours, that at the same time that Germany announced a pretty sharp 180 about contributing lethal aid to the Ukrainians, they mentioned the fact that as late as February, I remember reading an article about the LNG terminal at Brunsbüttel, if I'm pronouncing my German's horrible, the Brunsbüttel up in northern Germany on the North Sea coast, and another one, I think, further downriver near Hamburg and Stade, that they're going to build two of them there. You're right. Those take a long time. I think the one at Brunsbüttel was they already done some preliminary work on it. I haven't seen anything about the second until yesterday, but LNG tankers can't be built overnight as well. And if Germany, which is the largest economy on continental Europe, if they're going to use that as a substitute from what was coming from pipelines for Germany, and is there loose capacity for LNG tankers to be able to meet that demand, or do they have enough time because of the construction time for those terminals to make that happen, you think?
Well, I mean, Europe right now is pretty awash in LNG coming from across the ocean. There was strange stories before the Russian invasion of Ukraine when there was a concern and discussion about cutting off Russian LNG, China released several shipments of LNG that was heading their way to go to Europe. And there was a lot of questions about that. Why is China releasing these shipments? Why are they being permitted? And there was really two issues that were at play here. One, everybody thought, well, they're either have their storage at full capacity, and therefore this was just going to be extra. They didn't need it. Or they've been making deals with the Russians to get LNG coming out of this. And I think, again, one of the things that you see is the United States has become the world leader in exporting of LNG. We surpassed Qatar and Australia in December of this of last year. But the issue here is vessels to carry it. We, the United States, don't have any vessels to carry LNG. We're completely dependent on international shipping to do it. Russia, again, has a kind of a large gas fleet that they've been developing and building. That's a substantial gas fleet that's out there. A lot of it is moving the gas out of the Yamal fields into storage facilities in Europe. What happens to those vessels now? Are there sanctions against them? Can they be used? Korea is building LNG vessels at record numbers. I think somewhere in the range of 60-something LNG vessels are on order here over the next year. But the problem is it takes 1 to 3 years to build those vessels. When do they come out? And so there's a very big question right now, is especially if you get either a hot summer or a cool winter, is there enough LNG to fuel the power plants in Europe, particularly after they took a lot of the nuclear plants offline?
You know, and Chris, that's kind of interesting, that move by China. The Chinese don't really do anything for good PR. There's always a few layers to it. You know, this is probably one card of a multi-card coming deck that's being brought out. Where do you see over the course of the next year where China is going to do what one would expect her to do to try to take advantage of this situation?
Well, I think one, it looks like Vlad and Xi and their little bromance get together probably have a deal where China is agreed to underwrite a lot of the losses, a lot of the economic losses that Russia is getting right now. The problem with Chinese money is it's in very many ways a lot like mob money. Sounds real good at first. Yeah. Oh, we just want, you know, we like the restaurant here. Come on, why don't you stay in business? Don't worry about it. And everything's pretty good. And at some point, somebody shows up and, we'd like a little favor. And be careful what you ask for and be careful who you ask for it from. I think it works for the Chinese. China plays the long game here. And this Ukraine invasion attack makes no sense to anybody looking at it rationally. So this is not a rational move, especially from a master chess player KGB operative like Vladimir Putin. But the Chinese do play the long game as well as anybody, the Chinese and the Russians together. This is not a long game. It doesn't look like it. With Ukraine and the Russians, the Chinese are always playing the long game. So economically, okay, we got a deal, 5,000 word agreement here, full of all kinds of details. What will China do? This is an odd area, and we have no idea today how this is going to play out over the next weeks and months and even years. Things have changed. Things have definitely changed. And I know we're all tired of hearing that. We're tired of hearing it when Trump came in. We're tired of hearing it with January 6th. We're tired of hearing it with the pandemic. And now we're very tired of hearing it already with Putin coming out of nowhere to create this ridiculous crisis. But how does this play out? Everybody's worried about the Chinese and their seemingly inexorable rise. Xi is a very dangerous player. He's got the 20th Party Congress coming up sometime this year. The date hasn't yet been set, I don't believe. But everybody expects that to pretty much confirm him as, you know, leader for life. And that, of course, breaks the whole post-Mao construct that they've had. They have a navy that they've built as rapidly as anybody's built a navy since the U.S. during World War II, and Britain and Germany in the years leading up to World War I. This is breathtaking what they're doing. Great expense, great effort. Nobody knows if it's any good or not, if they can really fight. There's a lot of things in the world that are look really, really awesome in pictures. Of course, the trick is to know what you're doing with the equipment you've got. And one problem when you've got such a rapid expansion is you can't grow experience. The people operating those things have not spent 20 years coming up to the ranks. So they have to rely on other experiences like doctrine. Is your doctrine flexible? No, it's not. Is it based on what? Is it based on experience and efficacy or the ability to impose doctrine? Who knows? So they have this new navy. They have an amphibious. These three very large Type 75 amphibious assault ships look very much like our big 40,000 ton amphibious assault ships. They've just built three. The third one will commission this year. The first two are in commission. They're based on Hainan Island. They haven't really had a good demonstration with those yet. They've not done any major exercises. I kind of think that sometime in the relatively near future is going to be some sort of demonstration in the South China Sea of amphibious capability in some form, but they haven't shown those yet. They haven't used them. They haven't really used the second aircraft carrier they built, the Shandong. The Liaoning, the first one, the former Soviet-era ship, which, by the way, was built in Nikolaev in Ukraine, has been operating a lot, but they haven't done the second one yet, haven't had a good demonstration. This, of course, is a RIMPAC summer. World's largest naval exercise takes place based out of Hawaii, in the waters west of Hawaii, hosted by the United States. Both Russia and China, in happier times, were invited to participate. Will there be a demonstration or something there? I know that the interactions between U.S. and allied navies and the Chinese have been far more intense and interesting than have been publicly revealed. Will the Chinese want to respond when there's a lot of media showing up? But the point is that with all this, the unintended consequence of the invasion of Ukraine, Putin says he's worried about, obviously he's been trying to weaken NATO for years. Well, congratulations, Vladimir. You just strengthened NATO like nobody has done in decades. Way to go. NATO is presenting an extremely solid front, not a fractured group of self-interested countries at all. The alliance seems to be as strong as ever. Where will that lead? The United States is taking a leadership role again, and it's needed. It's very much needed. Will that resolve? And hopefully the resolve is the only way you're going to do in a box in Putin. Will that as well translate to Xi? They're not quite ready for a war yet. People say, well, he'll take advantage of this and go ahead and invade Taiwan now. It's a long way between mainland China and Taiwan. Taiwan is a lot like Ukraine in some ways. It's heavily populated. It's very mountainous. They're ready. They're armed to the teeth. They're not going to be easy to take at all. They're totally unlikely to surrender. You're going to sustain that operation. Carry out the initial assault. Can you sustain that? And will everybody put up with it? Because, again, these are all dominoes, and everybody's invoking World War II and the lead-up to that, and Czechoslovakia, and then Poland. So it's playing out in front of everybody's eyes. Here we go again. We know where this leads if you don't do anything. These are very dangerous times, very dangerous indeed.
What are you seeing there, Sal?
No, I kind of agree with Chris. I mean, if you can get the Swedes to send you 5,000 missiles, that shows you that that you know you're creating a polarity there. I mean, you got groups that normally would have sit this out and not get involved, and now they are. And I agree. This is probably the greatest kick for NATO to demonstrate the need for the alliance more than anything else. I mean, you know, the one thing about NATO you kept talking about all the time was it was designed for the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union's gone. You know, you don't need it anymore. Well, now you see the existential threat that the Russians pose. And, you know, whether or not they're successful in Ukraine, they've demonstrated their ability to use force. And, you know, I'm a historian. I have to deal with academics all the time. And, you know, academics would love to sit there and tell you that, well, you know, we're in the new history time. Things have changed. You know, I can't tell you the number of people who have told me we'd never again have, you know, a war like we're seeing right now in our lifetime. And, again, you can't rationalize irrational people. And that's what you see happening right now with Putin. And if Xi decides to go for Taiwan, for example, I think he can draw some lessons from this too. I mean, he's seen NATO not fully back Ukraine leading into this. I mean, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of pulling back the tea leaves here and recounting what happened, everything from, you know, the phone call Trump had with the Ukrainian president and trying to get arms and weapons to them to not providing more direct aid to the Ukrainians right from the very beginning. That's not the situation with Taiwan. I mean that's a much different situation out there. Plus, there's a lot of other nations at play out there that China has to worry about. And China's also in a much different position in regards to trade, I would say. They are much more susceptible to the economic coercion that's trying to be initiated against Russia right now. You see these sanctions being put in, for example, that, you know, five vessels were targeted. One was grabbed just yesterday by the French. Three are in ports. One's down off of South Africa right now that is probably going to be the next one that gets grabbed. But if you start putting economic sanctions against Sovcomflot, against FESCO, the major container line for Russia, that's going to have some economic impact. You're already talking about targeting yachts and economic holdings. And I think one of the strategies you're seeing done right now is to go after the oligarchs and make their lives miserable, because that would make Putin's life miserable. I think that they see that as the only leverage they have right now beyond supporting the Ukrainians in their fight.
Yeah, it's funny. I have to keep reminding myself that this war is less than a week old. And when we saw, you know, for the first 48 hours or so, there were, because of Germany's statements and actions, there was some concern with the solidity of the alliance. Hungary was being problematic as well. But it was amazing. As of a little more than 24 hours ago, once Germany made the turn, that you've just seen some amazing things happen with the unity of the alliance. And you also have the Finns and the Swedes, who have always been, quote, partnerships for peace. I've served with both folks. You talk about turnkey NATO members. If they decide, and I think Finland would probably go before Sweden does, they would be truly turnkey alliance members, that even though they're small nations of 5 and 10 million each, they bring a lot per capita to the table, not to mention just the geographical position of it. And we're coming near the end of the hour, and we'll start with you, Sal, so we get Chris the last word, because first question went to you. But, you know, here we are a week into the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and I was just curious. And it doesn't necessarily have to be maritime. It could be political. It could be on the land. It could be online, you know, whatever you think of. If we ran through this scenario over a couple of beers at Valentine's Day, what you would think then, a few weeks ago, to where we are today, something surprised you that you didn't expect to either happen or be important, but it has, and you've been impressed. And on the other side of the coin, something you expected to be executed, done, or to happen better or faster, but the reality just haven't panned out how you thought. Again, we'll start with you, Sal.
Yeah, I mean, just watching everything unfold, when he announced the independence of the two states in Donbas, I assumed that if he did go, it was going to be more focused on the eastern side of Ukraine. I mean, if I saw him make a move, it would have been out of the Crimea toward Donbas to get that overland route and maybe set him up along the Dnieper River there. The move against Kiev is the one that gets me. He's expending a huge amount of resources to get at the nation's capital. And, you know, it's too early to tell if that's the right decision, wrong decision, but it seems to become the focal point right now for the Ukrainians to really rally and make that fight. I don't know if that, you know, strategically is the move. I would imagine he was going to basically grab eastern Ukraine, create himself a buffer state, try to create instability in western Ukraine, because I don't think he wants to get himself up against the alliance. I don't think he really wants that border with Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and Romania. And so that's the one that has surprised me in the execution of it. What I haven't seen that I expected to see, and we still may see it, is the spill out of the cyber attacks. I think we've seen some of it, but we have not seen the widespread cyber attacks that have really proliferated this kind of fight between Ukraine and Russia in the past. I go back to 2017 when Maersk got hit by the Napietia virus. That wasn't an attack against Maersk Line. That was an attack between Ukraine and Russia, but it infected the Maersk system. It basically fried every one of their computers, half their 5,000 servers, and knocked off, you know, one of the largest container liners in the world for 3 weeks. Cost them $300 million. You know, if that happened today with the global supply chain crisis, it would be catastrophic. And so I think that's the issue, is we really hadn't seen the spill out beyond the borders, at least from the cyber side. I think the looming crisis, however, is the refugee crisis. I think that's going to be the one that catches everybody by surprise here, as the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, start spilling out of the Ukraine, especially should Kiev fall.
All right. Well, I would say Roger on everything that Sal just said. Absolutely. The problem with cyber attacks, though, is it really is a double-edged sword. And they're very good at it. They're not the only ones in the world who are good at it. And yep. Not only that, but this has created such a populist, there's such immense populist support around the world for Ukraine right now that there's going to be tons of people who are going to try to start messing with the Russians in all kinds of nefarious ways. And they may, this may go on for a lot longer than they bought. One of the surprises to me is I don't think the Russians are that good. I mean, we know that these are extremely tough people. And they have this military, which is certainly designed for war. Their plans here, this isn't working. The opening salvos, everybody who's gamed this stuff out knows you start right off with, you know, suppression of enemy air defenses, SEAD. They clearly didn't do much of a good job at that. They simply haven't. There is still Iranian Air Force assets. The Iranians do control certain a lot of airspace. The Russians do not have complete command of the air. You would have expected that to be just an all-out assault from multiple platforms, a vicious assault on Ukraine's air defenses and air force. That would just wipe them out within 2 or 3 hours. It didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Not entirely sure. Were they hoping that the Ukrainians would just give up? Would that there's so many Russian sympathizers inside of Ukraine that would rise up and be part of this? That's not happening. It simply is not happening. And again, for, you know, Putin to call this, you know, a joke country, you've completely revalidated, like NATO, you've totally revalidated Ukraine's sense of a country. We are under attack. And that's really impressive. I mean, everything that you say you're trying to break them up, it's gone the other way. These tactics, this entire affair is working against you. What's the end game here? You've got 200,000 troops arrayed against Ukraine. Right now, around 120 have been committed. Okay, you got a third left. You don't have a whole – that's an awful lot of your standing army, too, by the way. And these people are not ready for war. They're not prepared for this. They're not psychologically prepared. They're the Russian military people that – and, again, you got to be careful here with propaganda and wishful thinking. But they don't seem to be they seem to be wondering what they're doing there as much as anybody else. Putin did not set this up with the Russian people. You know, all of a sudden he announces his special operation and, oh, you know, these guys are drug addicts and we're going to denazify them. What? Where did that come from? I mean, seriously, Vlad is off his meds today. What is that? There was none of that. These people, the Russian military troops, aren't coming in to clear the nation of druggies and Nazis. They're not. They don't know what they're doing there. The Russian anti-war movement, in the face of really calling it robust threats to get arrested, is a total understatement. There's clearly a pretty large sense in Russia that, what is this all about? And they are taking significant casualties. Nobody has any idea what the real numbers are. But it's pretty clear just from random videos, it starts to stack up after a while, that a lot of people are being killed. And a lot of young Russians are not going home on 2 feet. That has an effect. It hadn't had an effect in Afghanistan when they were in Afghanistan. It's going to have an effect for the U.S. And, again, what are they there for? So let's say Ukraine, the mass of the Russian military machine is going to win. It's highly unlikely that at least the cities are going to hold out. You got 200,000 people on a country of how many millions? And it's a big country. And you can hold the cities all you want. There's a lot of country in Ukraine. You're not going to hold these people. You don't have the size of the military to take and hold a hostile nation. You just don't. And at home, that's a recipe for a downfall. So how do you overcome that? Well, then he uses a tactical nuke. Well, okay, now we really have a pariah. I mean, how does this end? Those are the worries.
Yeah, the whole discussion of the nukes, when you consider that not only is Ukraine a breadbasket, but a lot of the Russian breadbasket is all downwind from Ukraine. So, it's a nation that is roughly the size of Texas. Texas has a population of about 30 million. Ukraine has a population of a little more than 40 million. So it's a third larger than Texas. That's a lot of people, and that takes a lot of the army to secure. And I think, you know, that's the long play as we go into week two of the conflict, to keep an eye on. And I haven't seen, and I'd be shocked if I did see at this stage of the game, some real accurate mapping of whether the Russians are, how successful Russians have been to cutting off the supply lines going into Kiev. If they invest that entire city and try to do to it what they did to Grozny, I don't see the rest of Europe putting up with that, especially if they start using thermobarracks in those 14-story apartment blocks. You're killing thousands of people. It'll pop if they do that. So I think this week is going to be telling, because, gentlemen, as you both outlined, it's an interesting time and a very dynamic. And I do appreciate both of y'all taking an hour plus of your time today to join us. And just a reminder to the listeners, you can find both Sal Marcogliano and Chris Kavas on Twitter, if you're on Twitter. If not, they both have their own podcast. If you want to find Chris, just Cavus ships. That'll get you to where you need to go for your search engine of choice. And what is going on with shipping with Sal Mercogliano. And you'll be able to find his podcast and also writings as well. Gentlemen, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Sal.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next day, next time, hope y'all have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.